The practice of crop rotation in conventional farming, alternating between corn and soybeans, has become common practice in Iowa. New evidence shows that farmers might want to consider a longer rotation. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we'll talk about a recent study that was conducted on an Iowa State University research farm. Over a period of 8 years, researchers studied three different crop rotations and found that farmers can maintain their profits with a three-year or even four-year rotation. Today I'll talk with some of the lead researchers on this study, an agriculture economist who can break down the numbers, a farmer, and one of the nation's leading experts in sustainable agriculture. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. There was a time, long ago, when some farmers would grow a specific crop on a field until the field would no longer produce. Times have changed dramatically. The use of fertilizers, weed management, and disease-resistant crops revolutionized agriculture. And farmers today can produce harvests that were once unimaginable. But we are still learning new things about land, fertility, and farming. This hour, we'll talk about a new study about the benefits of longer crop rotations, more than the standard corn and soybean rotation employed by so many Iowa farmers. And my first guest this hour is Adam Davis. He's a research associate with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He's also a crop sciences professor, associate professor at the University of Illinois, and he was the lead author of this study, which took place at Iowa State University's Marsden Farm. Adam, first, tell me about the basis of the study. This was a long-term study, right?
Yes. We started in 2002, and we looked at 9 years of the data in this article.
And from 2002 to when you decided to compile your data, what did you do?
Well, this is a cropping systems study, and we were looking at three different cropping systems, a two-year corn-soybean rotation, a three-year corn-soybean wheat rotation, in which the small grain was underseeded with a forage legume, and then a four-year rotation in which we had corn, soybean, oat, and oat underseeded with alfalfa, followed by a year of alfalfa. So we grew these crops, and we measured inputs to the crops, looked at weed growth and competition with the crops. We harvested crop yields and just managed it at a scale that a farmer might look at and feel familiar with.
And what kind of methods did you use to manage the land during that time? These were conventionally grown crops, right?
That's right. The two-year rotation was managed with best management practices from a commercial standpoint. So we were following Iowa State Extension recommendations using synthetic fertilizers and chemicals, herbicides at the labeled rates. In the 3 and 4 year rotations, we were looking at the potential for complementarity between the different crop phases of the rotation to provide some ecosystem services in which we substituted producer knowledge and management expertise for some of the inputs going into that two-year rotation.
So for people who don't know very much about farming, what does that mean?
Okay, so in the 3 and 4 year rotations, we were banding herbicides in the row rather than broadcasting them. We were cultivating in between crop rows, so adding some physical weed control. We were using the plow-down nitrogen value of the legume green manure under the small grains to substitute for some of the nitrogen fertilizer.
And when you refer to legume green manure, we're talking about hairy vetch or another kind of crop that you can plant?
In the three-year rotation, we were using red clover, and then in the four-year rotation, it was alfalfa.
Okay. All right. So this was farming with what are considered to be more sustainable methods?
Yeah. Farming in which you're trying to create a system that's more self-reliant. And the systems that we used in this study are nothing new. farmers know about these systems. They've known about them for generations. What was different here was that we were doing a very careful accounting of what was going in and what was coming out.
And what did you find?
What we found was that in the 3 and 4 year diversified cropping systems, we were able to maintain food production, maintain profit, but apply far fewer inputs, synthetic external inputs, that is, and reduce environmental impact greatly.
When you say maintain profit, I think one of the things that makes a lot of farmers resistant to looking at a longer rotation is because we understand the market for corn and we understand the market for soybeans. These are pretty reliable markets. And of course, in recent years, especially the price for corn has been so high. So when you say maintaining profit through the rotation, you're making as much money as you would if you were growing corn or soybeans?
Yes, that's correct. Corn and soybeans have a well-known value, but they're not the only crops that have value. And the small grains that were grown in these systems, the diversified systems, have value, as do the forage legumes. But one of the assumptions that the more diverse rotations make is that animals are involved in the system. It presupposes a reintegration of crop and livestock production.
Explain that for me.
Well, right now, there's largely a dislocation between crop and livestock production, and so you produce grain concentrates that go to animal feeds and are shipped to concentrated animal production facilities somewhere else. And the nutrients from that grain that's fed to those animals becomes a pollutant where you have those confined animal feeding production facilities. In the integrated production system, you're assuming that you have animals nearby that are able to eat the products from your diversified system, and their manure, rather than being a waste product, becomes a valuable input to the system.
So you're talking about pasturing livestock on these lands?
No, we're talking about harvesting forage legumes and feeding that hay to the animals.
Okay, and then reintegrating the animal's manure into the land?
Well, so, I mean, integration at that level, but also integration in the sense that we're closing nutrient cycles and material cycles by having the animals be close by, and rather than shipping just that corn or soybean grain and having the product be dislocated from the land here, that manure is coming right back to the same land that produced the feed.
And we talked about the fact that you had a 3-year rotation and a 4-year rotation. You found in both of those rotations that you could maintain profits throughout. Was there a benefit to one over the other?
Both rotations were able to maintain profits, and both rotations were able to decrease environmental impact and the amount of synthetic external inputs applied.
Okay, and was there a benefit to the 4-year rotation as opposed to the 3-year rotation?
There was a slight benefit in grain yields, yep. And both of them, within the corn or soybean phase of the crop rotation, had greater corn and soybean yields than in the 2-year rotation.
Earlier, you mentioned that you used practices that are well known to farmers and have been known to farmers for generations, but this is not standard practice in farming in 2012. How groundbreaking is this study?
I think what's unusual and hopefully useful about this study is the long time span that we chose to look at these systems over and the careful accounting that we did. I mean, one of the things that I think is very useful about these data is that we got beyond the usual 3 or 4 year length of most agronomic studies. And one of the things that we know from watching our farmer friends and from other system trials is that there's a startup phase to these cropping system experiments. And if we had just written up those first 3 years, we wouldn't have seen much of a difference between these systems. They really began to diverge after year 4 or 5, and then there were really big differences.
What problems do you feel employing this kind of a system could help mitigate in the future?
Well, one clear problem is, the pollution of water through excess nutrients. And, you know, we see that with, you know, the media attention to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And systems that are that close nutrient cycles and use nutrients efficiently can help offset problems like that.
What's in it for the farmer, do you think?
Well, one of the things that we saw was increased stability of profits, so lower variation in profits from year to year. Part of the reason that cropping systems with longer rotations were common in earlier times was kind of as a way of hedging bets against environmental uncertainty. And so, you know, one year might be good for one of the crops in the rotation, but not so good for another crop. And so I think with the increased diversification comes increased stability.
Mark Bittman, a food journalist, recently wrote about this study in the New York Times, and he was very complimentary in the article about the study, but he was somewhat critical of the USDA. He said he was surprised that no one at the USDA would trumpet the outcome of this study. What was your reaction to reading that?
Well, I think that, you know, he wanted to stir the pot, and he did. But the USDA has actually contributed quite a bit to this study. So first of all, several USDA grants funded this work. They funded my time and allowed me to and supported me in my participation in the study. And at the time that that was written, you know, I had notified our publicity office about it, but USDA is a large organization and has many, many scientists. And so, you know, I think they were getting it to it on their own time.
And, of course, it's not your job to promote the study. It's your job to do the study. Now that this long-term portion of this study has been completed, do you have questions along these same lines that you're hoping to answer in the future? Do you have a new study that you're working on?
Well, I'm hoping that we can continue this same study and see what happens as we go further out in time. One of the things that we were excited about with these data, if you take a look at figure three in the article, we looked at cropping system performance from a bunch of different dimensions. We used multiple indicators of crop performance, and I would really love to see us broaden that even further. For example, what happens with disease, plant disease, what happens with insect pests. I think that this study is a very valuable resource, and I'm hoping that we can continue to invest our time and effort in it as we go forward.
Well, I hope you'll come back and talk to us again as you find out more.
Thanks very much.
Adam, thank you very much. Adam Davis is a researcher with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and an associate professor in the Department of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. In a moment, I'll talk with Iowa State University agronomy professor Matt Liebman. He's also one of the authors of the study. And later in the hour, Fred Kirschenman, distinguished fellow at the ISU Leopold Center, will also be here. And you're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about a recent study that was conducted on an Iowa State University research farm. Over a period of 8 years, researchers studied three different crop rotations and found that farmers can maintain their profits with a three-year or even four-year rotation. My next guest is Matt Liebman. He's a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University and the Henry A. Wallace Endowed Chair for Sustainable Agriculture. Hello, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for being here today. And we've already talked sort of about the nuts and bolts of this study. From your perspective, over the years that you observed and studied this land and the three different rotations that you were doing on the land, would you say that there was an appreciable difference in the amount of effort needed to be put into each one of these rotations?
Well, we've quantified the amount of labor necessary to operate each of the rotation systems. And my colleague, Ann Johans, will comment about this a little bit later, but it takes about 45 minutes per acre per year to run a corn-soybean rotation, whereas it takes about twice that amount of labor to run a four-year rotation with small grains and alfalfa hay added to the rotation. All that work is done with machines, but it does mean that a little bit more labor is required. And that labor, interestingly enough, is done at times of year that generally don't compete with the labor requirements for corn and soybean. It involves making hay during the middle of the summer and spreading some manure in the fall after crops are harvested. So there's more labor involved, but it's not necessarily a strong competition for what's involved in corn and soy production.
In looking at the profit margins, we'll talk about that in a moment, as you mentioned with your colleague Ann Johans, but let's talk about the other things that you can measure, not just the amount produced on the land, but also can you also measure the amount of soil erosion or the amount of runoff from the land?
We haven't done that directly, but we've done that indirectly in some quite dramatic ways. I had a student a number of years ago who was sampling the insects that crawled around the ground, and to do that you put little cups in the soil, and you see what falls in them as they wander around. The insects fall into them. And as it turns out, that when you put those cups out in periods of high rainfall, soil moves or it doesn't move into the cups. And in the corn and soybean plots, typically after a heavy rain, we'd find those cups that were several inches deep completely filled up with soil, whereas in the small grains and in the hay crops, we'd find clear water.
While you can't give us a quantifiable number, you can see that there was significantly less runoff.
A lot less soil sediment was moving in the small grains and in the alfalfa and in the clover during the early portion of the year when corn and soy really haven't set up their canopies. And there's not that much protecting the soil. In the small grain crops and in forage legumes like clover and alfalfa, you get that canopy shielding the ground and slowing down the raindrops before they hit the soil surface, and then you get much less displacement of the soil.
And again, I talked a few moments ago with Adam Davis about the application of fertilizer. Can you explain a little bit more in depth for us how the application of fertilizer and the other inputs was different in the longer rotations?
Yeah, so our basic philosophy is you measure to manage. And we wanted to do the best job possible in each of the cropping systems. So we would put some fertilizer down at planting in the conventional two-year corn-soybean rotation when we grew corn, and then we'd come back when the corn was about 8 to 12 inches tall. We'd measure the amount of plant-available nitrogen in the soil, and if we found that more nitrogen was required, we'd add additional nitrogen fertilizer. In the 3 and 4 year rotations, corn is the crop that needs the nitrogen, and we took credits for nitrogen that's fixed by clover and alfalfa. It comes out of the air and it's moved by bacteria into the plant roots, and then when those clover and alfalfa plants decompose, they release that nitrogen for a crop of corn that would follow them. We also took credit for the modest amount of manure nitrogen that we were applying. We applied manure every 3 or every 4 years, depending on the rotation we were in. So we had some credits, and by knowledge of what those credits were, we didn't put any fertilizer down at planting when we grew corn in the longer rotation systems. But we did come back, and we sampled the soil when the corn was about 8 to 12 inches tall, and we determined on the basis of those soil tests where additional fertilizer would be useful, and we would add it if the threshold value was a certain level. So in some years we did use synthetic fertilizer, but in many years we didn't have to add any, and that would be a function of the weather and what was going on in terms of rainfall. So our nitrogen management practices were on the basis of measurements and putting in inputs where and when they were required. Our weed management practices in the longer rotations did use small quantities of herbicides, but the idea was that we would put them directly over the crop row where mechanical cultivation is a difficult way to control weeds. Between the rows, it's quite easy to control the weeds with one pass of a cultivator. We also took advantage of the diversity of crops within the rotation sequences that went beyond corn and soy to include oats and clover or alfalfa. Turns out that oats and the forage crops interfere with the life cycles of many of the weeds that are common in corn and soy. Those weeds in corn and soy include things like common water hemp, foxtail, and they're kind of synchronized to the life cycle of the corn and soybean crops, which are typically planted here in April and May and mature in September and October. And when you grow a small grain crop that matures in July and then you combine that crop off and you chop off the weeds, and when you take four cuttings of hay during the course of a summer, every time the weeds come up and try to get to the point where they produce some seeds, you interfere with their ability to reproduce. So those cultural practices and the differences among crops in terms of when and how they grew allowed us to eliminate the use of herbicides in the oat crop and in the clover and the alfalfa, and it allowed us to dramatically reduce the amount of herbicides involved in corn and soy production. And interestingly enough, the seed banks of weeds in the soil decreased in all of the systems. So our weed problems were becoming less of a challenge over time in each of the systems, regardless of whether we were reducing herbicide inputs or not.
So if you were looking at this over 12 years or 16 years, you might even see that become less and less of a problem over time.
Right. And that has really useful implications with regard to managing weeds over the long term in areas of the country like Iowa, where we're seeing resistance to the commonly used herbicides becoming more prevalent.
Well, I want to bring Ann Johans into the conversation now. And Matt, stay with us. You'll stay with us through the rest of the hour, I hope. And also,
sure.
You're welcome to join this conversation. If you have questions for Matt, if you're interested in this study, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Ann Johans is an Iowa State University economist and an ISU Extension Program specialist. Hello, Ann.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today. And let's crunch some of the numbers of this study, because both Adam and Matt have said that farmers can maintain their profits over the period of this 3-year or 4-year rotation, just as they would with a corn and soybean rotation. But as Matt just told us, it takes about twice the amount of time per acre. So how did you take all of those numbers into account when you talk about maintaining profits?
So when we looked at the study, we applied our cost of crop production numbers to the various field operations and used farmers' costs for the fertilizer. And so while there were higher labor requirements, those were taken when you looked at then the decrease in fertilizers, that is where the cost savings really occurred in those longer rotations.
All right, so it might take more time, but you'll save money because it will take less in the input category.
Right, exactly. Those synthetic fertilizers and herbicides were really the major increase in cost in that 2-year rotation.
And again, we've been using this term maintaining profits. Is that the whole story? I mean, do you basically maintain the same amount of income every year? Are there some crops that are more profitable than others?
So the corn and soybean crops were the most profitable in all the rotations. But then the oats rotation was still, it did have a much lower income, but it also had a much lower cost. And then the alfalfa in that 4th-year rotation does have a higher, it has a much higher labor requirement, and so it did have some higher costs. But then the 3-year rotation was really the winner when we looked at the both the production cost and then the return to management. The 2-year rotation, when we looked at the period of 2006 to 2011, we cut out when we were looking at the economic cost of these, we cut out those startup years kind of and really looked at the years where the rotations were established. And so that the 2-year rotation had an average production cost of $279, whereas the 3-year was quite a bit lower with a production cost of $181. And then the 4-year was just slightly higher than that with a production cost of $203 an acre. And then for that same period, when we used average USDA crop prices for calculating our income for the rotations, and so the return to management for the 3-year was the highest at $194 an acre, and then the 2-year followed that at $188, and then the 4-year rotation was slightly lower at $171.
With some of these alternative crops, is it more difficult to get these crops to market?
I think that's something to consider, but one of the benefits of in those three-year and four-year rotation was the application of manure and the cost savings from using that for the crop nutrients. And so in a rotation where you're using that livestock manure, you might also have a use for the alfalfa or the small grain in your farm operation. And so I think there might be higher costs in getting those crops to market, but you also might be able to utilize them on the farm.
All right. I'm talking with Ann Johann. She's an Iowa State University economist, and Matt Liebman is also here. He's a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. You're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. And Stephen is on the line from Fort Atkinson. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning. How are you all doing today?
Great. What would you like to talk about?
Well, a few things. First of all, thank you for putting this on the air today. I think it's a deeply, deeply important topic in contemporary America, and I think it's a shame that this hasn't seen more light as far as, publicity. And so I'm really happy to turn on the radio today and hear it. We're in the third year of our organic transition this year and just got the corn out. And even with the drought and having neighbors, we do a five-year rotation, rye, oats, alfalfa, alfalfa, corn, and beans. We winter rye. But even this year, having neighbors with 40 bushels to the acre, as little as that, we pulled 120 on corn. And I think that increased organic matter in the soil really helped to hold a lot of moisture that the neighbors didn't get to hold. And then I one more comment. And I think that the inevitable conclusion of this study is that we need more farmers. The labor requirements are such that we need more young guys on the land doing the labor. Making hay is a pretty big project on a, say, 6,000-acre farm. I mean, a quarter of that in hay, that's a lot of hay to get made in 3 or 4 days.
Sure.
For one manager. And so I think the inevitable conclusion of this study is that we need more farmers. So I'd be interested in hearing what they have to say about that.
Okay. Stephen, thank you so much for your call. And first of all, Matt, I talked about this a little bit with Adam, but this was not an organic operation, and we hear a lot about the dichotomy between organic and conventional farming. This was using sustainable methods, but not organic, correct?
This was not a study of organic versus conventional agriculture. So our longer rotations used about a 90% reduction in synthetic fertilizer and herbicide inputs over the 9-year period. But they did use some synthetic fertilizer and herbicides. And it's similar to an approach you might take with your own health, which is when you get a serious infection, you might take an antibiotic to address that problem. But on other days, when you're not ill with an infection, you don't take the antibiotic. So our approach here was to measure what was going on with regard to soil fertility and weed dynamics and use conventional agricultural chemical tools to address those problems, but only when and where it was necessary.
But at the same time, as Stephen was just saying, you were building organic matter in the soil.
It takes a long time to see really big differences in the overall amounts of organic matter, but we have detected significant increases in certain fractions of the organic matter that are more responsive to crop rotation and other types of things that you can do in the shorter term. And his point was really right on. There have been studies done by other soil scientists, not my group, that have shown that for each additional percentage point of soil organic matter, you can increase soil water holding capacity 33%. So practices that are going to maintain or improve soil organic matter and soil physical structure will be really important if we see more years of moisture stress like we had in 2012.
So as Stephen was saying, I mean, it sounds like you're talking about, in this study, a fairly middle-of-the-ground approach. A conventional farmer can continue to use some of the same practices that they've used all along, but by putting in a longer rotation, they can maintain their soil quality for longer and have some significant benefits for themselves and for the environment. while not going organic. But Stephen's other point about labor, I can imagine that a lot of farmers would say, now, wait a minute, I'm already working my fingers to the bone. I can't put in twice as much effort per acre.
Well, let's go back to the discussion we had a little bit earlier. So there is more labor required in those more diverse rotations, but we're talking about labor at times a year when it doesn't necessarily compete with corn and soybean management activities. So, you know, it could be that you want to take much of the summer off and go do something else. You don't want to hassle with producing hay or combining small grains. And that's fine. But for other farmers that want to reap some of the benefits of this diversity with regard to lower input costs and some changes in soil quality that can be beneficial, some other things we've observed, including lower disease pressure in soybean, if you want to get those kind of benefits, there has to be a bit more labor involved. And it's done with machines, right? I mean, it's not all talking about backbreaking work. We're talking about going to an hour and a half per acre per year as opposed to 45 minutes per acre per year.
We need to take a quick break here. We'll get back in just a moment. My guest is Matt Liebman. He's a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. Anne Johans, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Anne Johans is an Iowa State University economist and ISU Extension Program Specialist. Matt will stay with us. So again, you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about a study that was released this summer. It was conducted on an Iowa State University research farm, and over a period of 8 years, researchers studied three different crop rotations. They found that farmers could maintain their profits with a three-year or even a four-year rotation. With me is one of the lead authors of this study, Matt Liebman. He's a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University and the Henry A. Wallace Endowed Chair for Sustainable Agriculture. And I also want to welcome now George Schaefer to the conversation. He farms with his brother Steve near Kelowna on a farm that's been in the family for 125 years. Hello, George.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you very much for being here today. And George, just give us a little bit of an overview of your operation.
Our farming operation is both conventional and organic, about half and half. We farm about 1,000 acres. We also have a cattle herd of 140 head of cows. So that's basically an overview, a quick overview.
All right. So it sounds to me like yours is the kind of operation that this study is directed toward. When you look at the details of the study, what do you think?
Well, I've seen Matt present this data at a Practical Farmers of Iowa meeting, and I think that the material is real good for long-term what we're going to do in the agricultural world. His point about labor just sticks in my head the whole time about what we're going to do about labor. And I feel like I run way too fast all the time. And so how I'm going to, I should say ahead of time that my organic system has this 4 or 5 year rotation in it. The conventional system, we do not. We do a basic corn and soybean rotation. And I cannot imagine trying to make more hay in my life.
Well, so George, I mean, you see the benefits of something like this long-term for the sustainability of agriculture. What are the hurdles that you see besides labor?
Well, there's a secondary hurdle you touched on it a little briefly. I didn't catch the whole beginning, but the current infrastructure of agriculture is set up for a corn and soybean system. Where we take our products and so forth, there are elevators set up that take our corn and beans, and that is all set up so that in order to go to oats, if all the farmers went to oats out there, the oats market would tank. I mean, there's already an adequate supply, I think. So I'm not sure where the demand would come from. I do not know enough about if oats can be substituted in rations for other things like corn and so forth, but I'm not sure where the other thing would be. There would be a glut of hay also, and so those two things would have to play out somehow in the long run.
Well, Matt, you've been traveling around, obviously talking to farmers about these results. Are some of George's concerns the ones that you run into frequently?
Sure, they're very real, and I'll give you a couple of things to think about. I have worked in areas of the country where you have custom hay operations that come in and will alleviate some of the labor constraints that George referred to. So just imagine if we had a suitable number of farmers producing hay, and you had some specialized operators that could provide a service to those farmers in the same way that conventional farmers have custom operators put on fertilizer and herbicides. So that's one thing to consider. Small grains do have a feed value, a little bit less than corn, but crops like barley are very widely used in many places of the world, including Canada and Europe, as a concentrate for feeding swine and cattle. And oats, of course, have a long history of being fed to horses, but can be fed to other livestock as well. So I think, you know, the concerns are very real, and, you know, how we're going to deal with producing hay on a large operation requires a lot of attention, but I also think there's some ways that we can address that problem creatively. With regard to a glut of small grains like oats and hay on the market altering prices, that's true, but you can also get back to Ann Johann's point, which is that farmers who are integrated with livestock operations such that most of those crops, the small grains as well as the corn and the hay, are fed to local livestock, may be able to alleviate some of that marketing concern.
Well, George, thank you so much for being a part of our conversation today.
Sure. I would like to say one thing that I did hear somebody speak before that the reason farmers used to have a more diversified operation was because of the drought, or because of weather factors. This year we grew wheat, barley, oats, all sorts of things, and they all did and soybeans, they all did very, very well this year. Corn did average or less. So it is true that happens in a year like this year.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for your comments, George.
All right. Thanks.
George Schaefer farms with his brother Steve near Kelowna on a farm that's been in their family for 125 years. And I want to bring now Fred Kirschenman into the conversation. He's a distinguished fellow at Iowa State University's Leopold Center. Hello, Fred. Oh, I have to take care of something here. Sorry about that. Hello, Fred. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you very much. And both Matt and Fred, I want to broaden the conversation out a little bit beyond this study, because there are a lot of things that we have known are better for the soil in Iowa and therefore better for farmers in Iowa that can have benefits downstream as well over the years. But there are things that we still don't see entirely adopted. For one of the things that springs to mind is that we still see fall plowing, not nearly as much as we used to, but there are a lot of voluntary things that farmers can do to sustain their soil that are not happening. Fred, how have you seen things changing over time?
Well, of course, I wasn't able to listen to the rest of the program, so I don't know what's already been covered, but I think, as everybody knows, the major problem right now is not what farmers know they can do, and Matt's research has made that very clear. The problem is the market infrastructure, which is what you know, farmers, of course, initially have to respond to. And that's determined by a system that we have put in place, which is essentially the same economic model that is used for producing anything else, whether you're producing computers or automobiles or whatever, growing crops. You have to operate by the principle of maximum efficient production for short-term economic return. And that's what farmers have to do. And the way in which you do that, again, regardless what you're producing, is you specialize, because that's the way to gain efficiencies. You simplify your management, also gains you efficiencies, and you go for economies of scale. And you know, farmers are put in a position where the market is demanding that they grow these very specialized monocultures, so corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, essentially. And so that's what they have to do. And so I think before we can expect that farmers can adapt the kind of the evidence that Matt Lieben's research has demonstrated so clearly is that we have to change the market infrastructure. And we probably won't do that until the current system doesn't work anymore. And we're probably not too far from that, given the increased cost of energy and the other inputs which are required in order to make these highly specialized systems work.
So what are you envisioning changing in the future that would cause farmers to feel like they need to change the way they operate?
Yeah, well, I think we're going to reach that peak very quickly now, where changes are going to take place. You know, there was an article just recently here about how cattle feedlot operations right now, in fact, one in Kansas is going to be closing because given the price of corn and the limited amount of livestock, given the drought and other factors, they're going to be closing, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for them to do the feedlot operations. And cattle feedlot operations aren't the only, part of this industrial economy. It's the whole system. And so eventually, I think the main thing we need, and the reason that I think that Matt's research is so important is because it indicates another way that we can do things in the future when the current system doesn't work anymore.
Matt, I mentioned earlier, we talked about the fact that you're out talking to farmers. Are you talking to farmers who are already feeling that the system's not working for them?
Well, I did talk to some farmers, and you know, another good example of how changes take place. The Leopold Center did some research on cover crops starting about 5 years ago, and when we first did, they were pretty much dismissed because, quite understandably, from the point of view of a farmer, you want to use your time in the fall to apply your nitrogen when it's dry, and it simply works better for this specialized system. And so cover crops were considered really kind of weird. But now as fertilizer costs go up, because, again, we're depleting our rock phosphate and potassium resources all across the planet, so these costs are going up, now farmers are adopting cover crops all over Iowa.
Right, and I've certainly seen a massive increase, just anecdotally, of cover crops this fall. Matt, I want to get your response to that, too. Are you finding that there are farmers who already feel that the system's not working for them?
Well, the last several years have been extremely profitable in Iowa. There's no doubt about that. But I think farmers have also taken note of a change in several factors that they're thinking about. Their future might not be quite as rosy as it has been now, or certainly more challenging with regard to making management decisions. Those three factors that I can talk about are unsettled weather. We've had floods and droughts in recent years that have challenged many farms. In 2008, the Iowa Department of Ag and Land Stewardship noted that 2.3 million acres, that's 10% of the row crop area of Iowa, suffered what they called catastrophic soil erosion. That was the loss of more than 20 tons of soil per acre in that really heavy set of rains we had in May and June. So weather is a concern. Drought, obviously, this year, but we've had floods. We're seeing a lot of volatility in the costs of production as well as in prices. And although that's worked out favorably in the last several years, I think farmers are aware that it doesn't always work, that the increase in production costs can chew up the profits that they had with high prices. So the opportunity for reducing variability in net returns to the farm operation and also reducing reliance on purchase inputs can mean maybe a more stable bottom line. The other thing that's going on that I think we're paying more attention to is changes in pests. So I mentioned earlier that we're seeing a greater prevalence of herbicide-resistant weeds to the dominant herbicide systems we have out here in Iowa. So we're going to have to adapt to that kind of challenge. The other thing that's going on is we're seeing some new pests showing up. For instance, in 2010, we had an outbreak of a soybean disease called sudden death syndrome caused by a soil-borne fungus. One of the really dramatic things we saw in these cropping systems plots was the 3- and 4-year rotations had soybean plants that were almost untouched by this sudden death syndrome disease, whereas right next to them, row to row, you could see that in the 2-year rotation, the soybean plants were very strongly affected and lost a lot of yield. And there's really no easy way to deal with that disease in terms of purchasing a different kind of seed or applying a pesticide. So some of these cultural practices, like rotation, may have a very beneficial effect to the farmer's bottom line by mitigating some pest problems that we didn't used to have.
Fred, I want to ask you, of course, there are other problems that are created by some of the practices of conventional farming, with too much nitrogen running into our water, and of course people who live downstream. There's a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico that is because of nitrogen in the water, and there are many people who believe that Iowa and other farm states need to have fertilizer regulations in place. Do you see a movement building toward that?
Well, sure. I mean, these are. I mean, there are really two kinds of problems with our current agriculture and food system. One is that the system is enormously dependent on a whole range of natural inputs. You know, fertilizers, fresh water, cheap energy, and these are all inputs that are that we're depleting. And the other problem is that we have depended on nature to absorb the wastes of the system, and the nature's systems are being saturated now, and so the dead zones which are appearing all across the planet, you know, are harmful to you know, a lot of people, and currently we're externalizing those costs. And but eventually, you know, the costs are gonna come back to us. And so, so again, these are, and I don't mean to sound, you know, gloom and doom here, because I think that we know that there are alternatives that we can use, but they don't work, farmers don't have the option to adopt them with the current market system, or at least not to any large extent. And so, so the important thing now is to it is not for us to try to force the changes, because I don't think that'll work, but rather to prepare for the changes when they come, because they will come. And that's the reason that the kind of research that Matt has done is so important, because that's a part of what you know, what we can do in the future, and we know we can do that.
I want to try to squeeze one more question in from a caller, Tom on the line in West Branch. Can you ask your question briefly?
Yes, thanks for having me. I had two questions. Your 3 and 4 rotations, could you compare and contrast that to the standard rotations that were used in the 50s and 60s in common farming practice? And how essential was livestock integration into the success of your 3 and 4 year rotations?
Sure. The common rotation here in central Iowa was corn, oats, what they called meadow, followed by another year of meadow, and that was basically oats underseeded with grasses and clovers, and then carrying that for another year. Soybean was less common up until about the 60s, so we've seen some change. Soybean has become a lot more prevalent, but what we're doing in our longer rotations is not so different what had been done in the past, with the exception of we're using modern crop hybrids, corn and soybean varieties with much improved yield potentials, disease resistances, things of that nature. And we have a lot better ability to monitor soil fertility and make adjustments. With regard to the integration of crops and livestock, as my colleague Adam Davis mentioned, we don't have livestock on the farm that we're producing the crops on, but we do return manure at a rate that's commensurate with the amount of concentrate feeds and hay that we would harvest from the plots. And as a consequence of that, the forage crops are fed to cattle and manure comes back.
All right. Well, Matt Liebman, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Matt Liebman is a professor of agronomy at Iowa State University. And Fred Kirschenman, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Fred Kirschenman is a distinguished fellow at Iowa State University's Leopold Center. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan, with technical support from Alyssa Weiss. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, New Bow City Market and the restored Paramount Theater. Cedar Rapids continues its comeback. This is Talk of Iowa.